Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Midtown Business Radio.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Midtown Business Radio. Stone, how you doing?
I am doing well, and I am still jazzed about last week. That was so much fun, going up to Wilmington, North Carolina, putting up a new studio. I love everything about that town.
Yeah, that was a great experience. Business Radio X has expanded outside of Atlanta into our first market outside of Atlanta, and we chose Wilmington because we had a good buddy that was a PR person here in Atlanta who relocated to Wilmington, and she's given it a go.
So we're not allowed to share her name, right? Are you trying
Absolutely.
To keep that a
secret? I'm not.
Ann Revelle Petcher.
That's right.
Is operating that studio up there. And we had a chance. I mean, right out of the box, we hosted a show with a couple of guests on, was it Friday?
Uh-huh.
So they're off and running, man.
That's right. Exciting times.
But I think they're going to need a check-in. I think that Michael and I might have to run up there and check in on them again. Because we didn't make it to the beach. We were in the downtown area next to the river and all that, and we visited Port City, Java.
Quite a few times.
Nick's Diner. I think the Bourbon Street Michael liked the best, but the Dixie
Grill.
The Dixie Grill was my favorite out of all of them. But, you know, they don't have anything on Atlantic Station, man. We got a lot of cool stuff happening here, too. So we have several folks we're going to get a chance to visit with. But first up on Midtown Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast the Grand Poobah, the CEO, the boss, Victor Antonio with Selinger Group. Welcome to the show, man.
Appreciate being here. Thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Yeah. Now,
Selinger Group, what are you guys doing for folks?
Sales coaching right now.
Sales coaching?
Yeah, just a little bit of that. People got to sell the product. Without selling the product, the economy doesn't move.
That's Stone's opinion.
I do believe that. And nobody eats, right? Without me, I'm the sales guy in our little operation. Without me, the whole opera falls apart. At least that's what I tell them.
And they look at us so bad, don't they? Salespeople.
So
no respect.
What's a mistake a salesperson typically makes?
Overselling, pushing in today's market. Nobody wants to be pressured to buying in today's market. You know, people want to make their own decisions. So, you know, you're starting to see a change in how people actually buy in today's market. Given the fact that you have social media, all this information, the best analogy I always have is that back in the day when you went to decide to buy a car, for example, you know, you would kind of ask somebody's opinion, maybe decide on a model, go to the dealership, spend 2 to 3 hours with the person, and boom, make a decision. Today, you search social media, you check at least 10 resources before you get to the actual dealership, and when you get there, do you want a relationship? No. You want a transaction.
You want the car.
Yeah. Give me the car. And so that's what's changed. You know, our attention span is shorter. We got more informed buyers. So pressuring people into buying, they ain't going to cut it.
So now is the selling less transactionally minded, though, or is it more consultative? What are you finding?
You know, that's a big question, believe it or not. It's what clients want today is insight. And I define insight as information beyond the obvious. Mm-hmm. So when somebody comes up to you and is trying to sell you something, if you're already familiar with the product, unless they're telling you something you don't know, think of going to Home Depot or Best Buy or buying something. If you're going there, you already have enough information of what you want to buy.
Right.
So you're looking for the transaction. And the only way you, the seller, can change my mind is by providing insight, information I don't know.
Right.
That will basically make me rethink the decision I've already made prior to walking in the store. So that's what today's salesperson has to have. They don't have that insight, knowing their business more than the consumer. It's going to be a tough sell.
Now, is that methodology work in only B2C, where a business person is selling directly to the consumer, or does that work the same in a B2B environment?
I think it's more important in a B2B, actually. In B2C, you know, it's more transactional. But still, you can provide those insights. But when you get to B2B, a more complex sale, much bigger sale, where the investment's that much larger.
Right, like when you're going to market and selling, you have to go to sales. People who have sales forces, I guess, are your clients?
That's correct.
So now, how do you sell a salesperson?
Is that different? Be the hardest? Is that the easiest or the hardest sale?
Salespeople selling a salesperson. Yeah. It's a conundrum, right? Well, what's interesting about today, what's changed in today's market, I've taken a different approach, is that I've leveraged, you know, the internet, social media, and I'll say about 90% of all my leads are inbound, which means that's a totally different philosophy, which means that they're coming to me, which means they're somewhat informed already. They've seen my videos. They've seen my programs. They've read my books, or at least listed my books out. So they know what they want already. So they've almost pre-qualified themselves by the time that they've gotten to me, which makes closing the deal that much easier, which is why I have a high close rate.
Now, is that the same methodology you recommend your clients to do?
Oh, absolutely. I think today, if you're marketing, if you're a small business, I put it in that context, well, a large company also, but if you're not using social media, and I hate to keep using that phrase because people throw it out like it's, you know, candy, But there's a strategy for each market segment. Mm-hmm. For me, people want to see me speak. It's a visual medium. In other words, they need to see me. They say, can that guy even talk right? You know right. what I mean? Type of thing. You know? Yeah, that Georgian thing comes out once in a while.
Really?
Right? Yeah, I've been around too long. And so when I do it in Spanish, it even sounds funnier. But what happens is that social media is important, but it's got to be part of a focused strategy and not just slapping stuff up on the internet thinking something's going
to
happen.
Right. And it might you have to pick the right social media platform, right? Like maybe Pinterest isn't best for you.
Excellent. Excellent point, because you're so right. And you don't know how right you really are, because people, they want to play in everything. Got Instagram, got Pinterest, got Facebook, got for me, my two tools for my business have been YouTube and LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Those are my two primary channels. Facebook, you know, not for me. If I was selling Matteo's Pizza, right. that I would definitely be on Facebook. But again, everybody picks their channels.
So now how do you work LinkedIn to your benefit?
What I try to do is the titles I look for, I'm very focused. I know who my profiles are, right?
Right.
So typically I look for director or senior VPs mm-hmm. of sales. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
Those are the people I try to connect to and engage. And so I think of LinkedIn almost as a golden Rolodex, but only if you really focus in on who you want to talk to.
Right.
If you're going out, I've seen people go on LinkedIn and just try to accumulate, you know, so many LinkedIn
like
connections. Yeah,
well, yeah. I got the most, like you
yeah,
win
I got
something,
to,
right?
You know, like size matters type of thing, you know? And so I'm always laughing at that because it's not focused. It's, again, it's just throwing stuff up
right.
on the wall, hoping somebody sticks. But if you're very focused about who you're going after, I think, you know, you're getting higher qualified leads.
And that's a good lesson yeah. for just the listener in general. You, if you know director of sales is who you got to reach, and you probably have a size of a company too, so you have
Absolutely.
A couple different qualifications, and you can hone in on only those people, then at least you're fishing in the right pond that has the right fish in it.
Exceptional point. So what I'd use LinkedIn, just as a side note, I'm looking for companies that are at least 20 to 100 million. That's typically a good, you know, that's my sweet
spot. So they'll
spot.
Hire you.
Right, that will
they
hire me.
They can afford
me.
To
that's
hire
good,
you.
Afford to hire me. That's a good point, by
right.
the way. And then typical sales force will be 25 to 50 people, somewhere in that range, mm-hmm. direct or indirect. But then I also use, there's a website called Manta, which is free, which allows you to look up some of these companies. And some of the information is not public. But I use those two things in conjunction. So I look up the company, who are they, obviously do the research, and then try to contact that company and make that connection. Mm-hmm. But I know who I'm going after. And the higher the average product sale is what I look for.
Right. If so that's, again, another criteria that's giving you.
In the profile. That's
right.
correct. So the bigger the higher product sale, which means that I can make my sales pitches that much better. So if you're selling a $100,000 product and you want to hire me for $10,000 to $20,000, it's like,
right,
come on.
That's nothing,
as
right?
a percentage. It's not a big
right.
deal.
But if the product was $5,000, now they're thinking I got to sell a couple, and then the math, it's not helping you as much.
I know. It's that simple, isn't it? It really
seems
is.
Pretty simple.
It's straightforward. I think we try to complicate things too much sometimes.
So the services you're providing, training, stand-up training, live training, or some of it delivered on other platforms? And does it also involve, I don't know, consulting, coaching to sales management teams? Or
how many questions was that?
Like, I know. One at a time.
Just like,
that's
man,
like
that,
basic
that's
radio
like a
host.
Gun coming
101.
At me. Stone, we were buddies up till now. What I do now, if I were to split my business, about 85% today is keynote speeches. Sales motivation keynote.
Like at an annual meeting or something?
That's correct.
Okay.
Like a sales conference. People right. bring me in, you know, fire the team up, but also provide some content. I try not to do the full rah-rah, you're the best, you're the greatest, you're the, you know, that whole thing.
But you will do that.
I will.
If the check clears, right?
If the check clears, I will do whatever you want. So, but what I try to do is make sure that if you go to my website, you'll see that I always ask my customers, what blend do they want? By blend, I mean, how much content do you want and how much motivation do you want?
The go, ratio, right.
right. And I do. So, and a lot of people ask me for the 50-50. That's what I'm getting. A lot of 50-50. Hey,
that means
content,
they
but
can't make a decision.
That's right. really what it means, right in the middle. But I think that's usually the best mix, because when you're talking to a sales force and you have people who've been around the business for a while, you know, they don't want to be fluffed to death. You know, like, yeah, what they want is real content. And so one
some
of the things
real tactics that they can that are actionable.
Some actionable tactics, some new strategy, or maybe some, you know, some of the new research that's out there on how people are buying.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I really look for is I read a lot of books on research. Anybody who's doing sales research, I try to really pull that information and then find ways to just, you know, I guess simplify the information mm-hmm. without data dumping on them, and then weave it into stories that are more motivational. And then, you know, in other words, tell a motivational story, support it with some great data, or tell, you know, share the data and say, hey, let me tell you a story.
Now, is that a good technique for a salesperson to use more stories and less kind of, you know, just rattling off features or benefits?
I think simpler is better. I mean, you know, back in the 90s, you know, fMRI machines came out. These are the things that look inside your brain, can tell you how you're thinking and all that good stuff. And what they're finding out that the left brain, right brain dichotomy really doesn't exist. What you're really finding is that there's the thinking brain, the prefrontal cortex, midbrain, the emotional contact, but back here somewhere, the stem, the amygdala, there's the survival brain.
Right.
And so if you understand that concept, when you're talking to somebody, and I'm trying to sell you,
I got my checkbook out right now. Almost.
As soon as I put my hand in your pocket, you perceive that. That's a threat.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the alarm system goes off. You shut down. You don't want to buy.
Right.
And so what you're seeing today in terms of strategy is, if we understand what triggers people, what motivates them to buy or make a buying decision, that's really what you want to do. So it's not about giving them a lot of information. It's really about going in, doing a presentation, being very clear. I always believe in, when I do a presentation, it's one narrative. What's my storyline? And three messages to support that storyline, because I'm trying to sell you one thing right now. And then later on, I can upsell you and cross-sell you on other things. And that's my philosophy.
So you have to kind of be aware of what's that point of entry.
Absolutely.
Right?
The point of the spear, so to speak.
Point of the spear.
Right. It's how do you come in? And after a while, you know, when I deal with salespeople, and I often talk to them, I often say, you know, on average, what the 3 to 5 typical objections are going to be when you sell. You do. If you're not,
well,
go,
you should,
right? If not, go ask somebody who's been around the block, or go do some data mining.
Or maybe ask your customer.
What an obvious choice, right? Ask your customers. The other thing is, you know what they typically buy if you just look at your database. You data mine your own data and figure out what people are buying, from what market segments, what products will they typically buy. And there's how you start shaping them. What I don't see a lot is salespeople are actually doing that. They get the slide deck. You know how it works. Come on.
Right.
You get the slide deck, and they put you in a training for a week. They give you a binder that's 3 inches thick after the training, after 1 week of training. Do you ever use the binder again? No. And so what happens is that people just try to just do the slide presentation and not make that connection.
Right. So it's almost like a memorized little shtick instead of just a let me learn about you and really get to know you and sell you something that can really help you.
Absolutely. And think about it. As soon as we feel that something is rehearsed, what do? We just kind of shut down.
Right.
So sometimes it's almost like selling without selling. If you're caught selling, you're screwed. You know, type of thing. You got to be. It's almost like you know where you're going. You know,
right.
I'm taking you, but I don't need you to know that. I just need to guide you there, type of thing.
So what are some other patterns that you see, good or bad, in salespeople?
Good or bad in sales? I think we've been using, if you look at the history of selling, I'm fascinated by the history of selling. Since the 1920s, for example, we've been using, you know, strategies. One of the first books was, The Psychology of Selling Life Insurance, and we're still using some of those techniques. And I would venture to guess that we'd all agree that things have changed since the 1920s.
I would hope so.
Right? And so you still see a lot of that. You know, customers today, for example, don't want you to walk in there asking them a lot of questions anymore. You know, there were, during the 80s, you know, a study done by the Huthwaite Corporation actually came out and says, you know, we want to ask a lot of questions, need analysis, develop the pain, you know, make a move type of thing. Well, today's consumer basically says, damn it, man, you should know what I'm all about before you walk in the door. And again, we get back to, tell me something I don't know, because
right.
I don't have a lot of time.
Right.
And so what happens is we're coming in with the old techniques, can I, ask me 20 questions, and the customer's going, okay, you're the fifth salesperson I've seen
today.
Let's run some numbers here. 5 times 20, that's 100 questions I'm being asked. And I'm answering the same question over and over again. So that's one of the biggest problems. The other one is just, if I were to point to one thing that I see that's one of the, I guess, the biggest crime in selling is that, God, we're horrible presenters. You know, I see salespeople do presentations, and I'm like, you know, when they're doing their reviews. Last week I was in Bangkok, for example. A large insurance company brought me out there, and I listened to the first three presenters, all salespeople, all veteran salespeople.
And probably their best, because they brought you in to share, show them off to you, right?
And so they're up there presenting, and I'm like, you guys are horrible. I mean, it was just horrible. And, you know, you're sitting there going, how do you guys even sell? You know, it's fascinating to me that the majority of people really can't present. They can talk. There's a big difference. They can talk, but they don't present in a way that people grab onto something, says, I get it. I understand what you're trying to say,
right.
Type of thing. And so, again, I see a lot of data dumping. You know, and I think sometimes we lean on PowerPoint a little too much. You've seen the slides, the one that has like 50 bullet
right.
points. You're
like,
okay.
You need like a magnifying glass to read it.
And then my favorite is when they actually turn to read it, like if you can't read
right.
it. Talk about, you know, and so.
And that's what their slides are, text.
Yeah,
you know?
That's it. It's pure text. And so you start seeing a lot of that. But even in the one-on-one conversations like we're having right now, is that in my head, when I'm talking to a salesperson or a client, rather, I have a structure of where I want to go and how I want to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's never a straight line. But at the end of that 45 minutes, I know that I have to hit certain marks at a certain point. I don't need notes in front of me. And I, when I talk to salespeople sometimes, I can tell they just –
They've never heard this concept before?
No. I think they go in there and they wing it. You know, they hope if I have a good conversation, if I present the product, that you'll have an epiphany. And go, wow, there it is. You know, Victor,
or maybe
I'll buy from you.
I just like Victor and I'll give you my money.
Yeah. And by the way, one of the studies done by the – there's a group called the Sales Executive Council came out with an interesting study. It was highlighted in the book called The Challenge Yourself, which I think is a fantastic book. Mm-hmm. I've read it several times. And it talks about how – today's buyer really doesn't want a relationship. A relationship is a result of a great sale. In other words, if I buy a product and I enjoy it, then I want a relationship with you, so to speak. So I love your pizza, you know, type of thing. I want a relationship. It's a result of the sale. We're still thinking that because you like me, I like you, we buy from people we like, that still applies. Well, it really doesn't, because in today's world where budgets are tight, you know, and they got to get approvals at certain levels now, I love you, man. I love you. But hey, tell me how I can justify
making some ROI.
That's right, return on investment. There you go. And so that's what you're starting to see today. We're moving away from the relationship, and it's more about show me the ROI.
Like the relationship's a bonus.
Absolutely. It is. It is. You want a great relationship with somebody, but it isn't about price. Studies have shown it's never been about price, really.
Right.
We've all bought products or service from somebody at a little higher price only because we felt comfortable, right?
Right. It's so, that peace of mind.
That's right. You can't put a value on that.
Exactly.
You know, so the higher the value, the higher the transactional price, the more you want the after effect in terms of the relationship. Mm-hmm. But up front, I need to know that there's an ROI there.
Right.
So do you ever worry about the sales manager? You go in, you do a fabulous talk or whatever, and the sales manager untrains them quicker than you can train them.
Yeah.
Does that ever happen to you?
That's his whole job security, right?
But you are so on point, though. You are so on point. It's almost like we focus so much on the salespeople, right? And so you train the salespeople, but you hardly see managers get trained. And then they go up there. I don't care what Victor said here. Now that he's gone,
now that he's out of here,
here's what I need you to do. And so typically today, in today's market, what you're finding, I think the realization is starting to hit people that you need to train your sales managers, because if they don't have the objectives, the outcomes that they want clearly laid out for their salespeople and how they're going to achieve them, then guess what? The salespeople are going to revert back to their old patterns. They always do. Path of least resistance, right? You always go back to what's easiest. And so if we train salespeople, we never train the sales manager. What typically happens? We go back to the old school. So,
right, but that's good. They'll hire you next year.
There you go.
They'll have to repeat that business. Sales manager.
But it's sad, though, because you don't really want to come back. You really want to say, look, this really worked. Great, you guys are growing. Let's do some training that will now take you to the next level.
Right.
But it often seems like we always go back to square one. And that's sad.
So what's next for you? A cadre of Victor disciples, or you're just going to continue to grow your own practice?
No, a cadre of Victor disciples, yes. My own dominion. The Sullinger Group really launching this year is I'm going to focus on a coaching program where I will bring in, as you say, little minions.
So you're training coaches.
To coach people. Yeah, teaching my philosophy, my disciples to go out there and just preach my religion. But I think what I want to do today is that there's a lot of business out there for all of us. It's a huge market. And there's a lot of good sales trainers out there, but, you know, again, I like to kind of formulate my own sales process and maybe develop some coaches.
Some methodology so
Absolutely.
They can take your methodology.
Absolutely. And something that's streamlined, simple, that's really real world today's market and makes sense.
So what's the best way for our listeners to reach out and learn more and have a meaningful conversation with you about this?
The easiest way to remember is victorantonio.com. Email is victor@victorantonio.com. Has my name, number, and all that good stuff. You'll see all kinds of videos on the website. On YouTube, I have over 500 videos. If you go to my website, you can download any of my 14 books. I also have, I think, 11 or 12 video series on selling different topics, and they can download all that for free. And by the way, no email is required. So,
wow.
Isn't that cool?
That is awesome.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been fun having you in the studio,
man. Thank you guys
for
having me. I really do
appreciate
it. Do
you have any clients here locally?
Here, who would be locally? You know, you're not a prophet in your own country. Did you ever hear that
one? Right.
That is me. 99.9% of all my business is outside of state.
So you're smarter outside of the state?
It's amazing how it is. I hate to confess that truth, but there it is. And I would like to reverse that trend because I really don't like traveling that much. So, you know, pray for me.
Well, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely. Looks like you got some great guests here today.
Yeah, we do. And Michael, please leave his mic open. He might have something smart to say or least funny and energetic. Right? So next up on Midtown Business Radio, we have with us the co-founder with Acceleration Partners, Jody. And Jody, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the last name because I forgot to ask before we went on air. I'll let you do it.
Well, I'm not. It belongs to my husband, so I.
Okay,
I won't
so we don't really care.
Yeah, we don't really care.
Just Jody with Acceleration.
But it's Charlotte.
Charlotte. Okay, so Acceleration Partners, tell us about this outfit. What kind of good work are you out there doing?
Well, where Victor may train the sales folks, we make sure that the organizations can foundationally be structured with great leadership. So we do coaching and leadership development.
Oh, leadership development. Is that a problem? You think there's a lack of leaders?
Well, let's just say as long as corporate America continues to abuse its people, I will have plenty of work to do.
Corporate America's abusing people? What is this you're saying?
That's pretty bold. So your backstory, what compelled you to get in this line of work? Did you have a real job prior to all this?
Yes, I did, believe it or not. I spent 18 years in corporate communications and marketing, working with a lot of companies in Atlanta and Silicon Valley, and just began to see that, you know, no matter what great product or great company you have to sell, if it doesn't have a good leadership foundation, I watched a lot of companies go out of business, fall on hard times, and it had nothing to do with the product. It had to do with, do you have sound leadership that's leading the company forward?
Now, how does, like you hear about corporate culture, does leadership play into corporate culture, or are they the same thing?
Well, absolutely. It depends on the size of the company. I mean, if you're in a smaller company, the leadership is the culture.
Right.
You know, you've got early stage companies where companies are very personality driven. The entrepreneur is the culture.
Right.
But as you get to larger organizations, you begin to see you have different subcultures like neighborhoods.
Oh, like in departments or
yes,
something?
Yes, absolutely. So a large corporation can have one overarching culture, but there'll be subcultures, just like you can go down the street and go, ooh, that's a neighbor I don't want to live next to. So, but at the end of the day, leadership really sets the tone and the culture of an organization.
So it's top down.
Yes.
So we touched on this, or we started to maybe a little bit when we talked about the sales manager and Victor's segment. And that's where I've seen it happen. A really good salesperson gets rewarded. You make them a sales manager, and they're not so much of a leader. You run into this transforming producer to leader challenge in your work, don't you?
I do. I do indeed. Just because you're a good producer doesn't mean you dance in the leadership role effectively. So a lot of times in the work we're doing, we're really helping people understand that the role of producer, the role of manager, the role of leader are very different roles. And in today's time where things are very lean and we're doing more with less, you know, a lot of folks are wearing multiple hats. And
amen.
And some people don't dance very well, or they'll have one dance move where, you know, I was a great producer, but I look really awkward. We're doing the two-step in that leadership office.
Victor's going to use that in his next keynote, yeah, I can tell. That's a,
now, is this something that...
Just give me a plug or a little mention.
Will do.
Can you train a leader, or is this something you're born with?
Well, you know, Warren Bennis is a great leadership guru and has written an amazing amount of works, and I admire him very much. He says, you know, it's very dangerous if we believe that leaders are born. You know, leaders are really made by their experiences from early childhood all the way up until the adversity that they've faced. So I think definitely leaders are made, and there are a lot of skills in becoming a great leader, and it's hard work. You have to really want to be a leader, develop the skill sets, and really empower yourself to do great things.
Now, how do you get an opportunity? If you're training leaders, don't the people think they're already good? Like, what?
Otherwise, I wouldn't have been promoted to leader.
Right.
Course,
like, how do they go, you know what, I'm good, but you know what, I need Jody's help.
Well, you know, I tend to work in two segments of the market. I work with the emerging leader. They're the up and coming leaders who really want to build.
So they're in
and
a
grow.
Position of leadership, but they don't.
They may want to get to the C-suite, or they right. may want to grow, or they may want to take on a new challenge, or they may want to get up in a larger organization. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is, you know, leaders want to grow and develop, and they want to be better. So they're like athletes, you know, like being a corporate athlete. It's like, I've done a certain set of goals. You know, if you're there, then you may have a leadership challenge. You know, if you're like, well, I don't have anything to improve.
But do they recognize it and would hire you? That's my question.
Depends on the leader. Some people will. I mean, I've worked with some great leaders who are doing great, and they're just always trying to up their game. What can I do next? What can I do better? And I think that that great leaders really are always
are kind of lifelong learners and want to really kind of get as much counsel as they can to keep improving. No. And the people who don't have people like you helping them, they're probably not great leaders.
Well, denial is a wonderful tool in the psyche. It really boils down to a leader's job is to develop other leaders. So really, are you preparing your organization mm-hmm. for growth? And if you're, if you don't think you have anything to develop and grow, then you're probably not leading your people with the same philosophy.
Right.
So do you ever get this call? And Jody, we want to hire you to fix Bob.
It's not me. It's not my leadership style. Right. But, I actually have a funny client in financial service, and he says, "Are they fixed yet?" And I'm like, "We're working on it." But it is interesting because a lot of times we think we can abstain from leadership. I mean, we're busy. Leaders have a lot going on. But the job of leaders is to develop other leaders. And so I can, as I always say to my executives, I can work with you. I can help your team grow. But leadership is contact sport. You got to be involved, and you got to be engaged.
You can't delegate this out.
As handsomely as you like to pay me to do it, but unfortunately, you're still going to have to be involved. Just works that way.
Now, are you seeing, is there any difference in your coaching? Or is it coaching? What do you call it, what you do?
Consulting? Executive coaching.
Okay. Coaching for women or men leaders?
I do. I mean, I have a pretty balanced practice, but I have seen there's a lot of movement in terms of helping women mm-hmm. Take their place at the leadership helm. And, about 2 years ago, I was a former female executive and had a great career and had great male mentors and great mentors overall, but began to see the patterns and trends that and was staggering that I thought women had it going on. We've got 80% of consumer buying power and a lot of other things. And then I realized for the past decade, women have not advanced significantly to the largest to the heights of leadership in our largest institutions. So I begin to think, what gives here, and right. how do we begin to help women live out their full potential as leaders? They have excellent skills and exceptional ability to lead, but there were some patterns and trends that are really hindering women from being
so
as powerful.
So what are
as
some
can
of those
be?
Patterns?
Well, we got to get the men out of the way. That's first the problem. Of all,
remove
we're
the men.
We're taking over the world. We're shopping a lot, and we own the buying power. Now we just got to get them out of the way.
All right.
No, seriously speaking, I think that it really is helping women understand some of the natural biases. Like any major social change, it's understanding the biases that are there. But you know what? The world is biased, and we're always fighting the good fight to get different causes and different things evolved. But organizations need a lot of the skill sets and talents today because we're running more complex organizations. Women have a lot of natural talent and abilities that they can bring to the table that are uniquely different from men, thank
right.
God.
Now, we've had some women here in leadership roles that are involved in in technology where there's not a lot of women in, mm-hmm. in leadership in technology companies. And they were talking about how some of it is the women just not kind of asking for the order or not pushing and bragging about their work that they're doing so that they're recognized for these leadership positions. Are you seeing that?
Well, absolutely. I think there's a visibility issue. I mm-hmm. mean, I think the first issue is I think women are extremely competent. They're extremely busy. And so, if you want something to get done, ask a woman to do it. I have a gentleman who's lauded in his company for having a team of high-performing women. And I'm like, you can laud him for his leadership development, but he knows good talent when he sees it. These women right. are working hard for him. But I think it's really about helping women get out of the production trap. I mean, women, particularly if you're moving to levels of leadership, and this is not just a women's issue, it's a men's issue as well, is we're so busy as a society, we're not creating space to lead. And I think for women, it's about creating more space so they can step back to do more. So women take on a lot in their roles. And then the second piece is just really beginning to think about, how to create that value. And a lot of times, if we're all things to all people, we're master to none. So
for the emerging leaders, don't they often run into that they're leaving the peer group and now they're becoming a leader and they start getting this vibe of, oh, man, you've changed. How do you help them navigate when they go from being one of the worker bees to being a leader, or are they running into challenges with that?
Well, I mean, I think that's, I think that's a common thing that people evolve into when they, we always kind of want to, we always judge ourselves by our peer set. How are we doing against Bob or Sue or right. Sally? But it does happen, meaning when there's a power differential, it's it does impact the relationship. We begin to have an identity shift, just even a title shift. It's like, I was the same person, I just have a new title, and now everybody's treating me differently because I have a title.
Or, right, and maybe you don't get invited for drinks after work and all that kind of
thing. Because now I can't, because you're my boss. I can't tell you the things that I told you before. So, you know, those identities and titles and roles can sometimes be confusing, but I think it's all about relationship and understanding how to not only manage how you're moving into a place of power, but how you're managing people's relationships when you continue to work with them.
But regardless of gender, they can get caught in that production trap and keep trying to be good at what they were good at and trying to lead. Are there some tactics, one or two tactics you can share with us to help you avoid that production trap?
Well, first is consciousness. Just kind of recognize that, you know, there's this paradox. It's like time is not a renewable resource, as we know. But if there you have too much of you, it's kind of like stock, supply and demand. The more there is of you, the more commonplace you become. And so we think we're working hard and driving more value, when the reality is a little scarcity is not a bad thing to wield your power. So you really have to first be conscious that we are caught in that production trap. And mm-hmm. value is not a pound of performance. It really is looking at the things of value. In your life, in your business, for your team. So first of all is the recognition. And then dialing it back and figure out what's really important. One of the things I teach in my coaching is how to say the gracious no. You can't take on everything. And it doesn't mean you can't help people. But, you know, you want to be able to say, hey, I'm flattered you asked me to do that, but no. or let me introduce you to a resource I know that can help you with that. I've got, you know, a couple initiatives on my plate. And I know you deserve the best person to do this. And right now, I'm not the best person. So there are just different ways you can help people or be able to say, hey, I'd love to be involved with this, but not this quarter because I have a big initiative that's coming down. Can we get together next quarter and talk about it again? So it's really about owning your destiny. We have more control over our lives than we take.
But you just got to take it.
You just got to take it. And have that conversation with yourself frequently and annually. Have that plan and say, what am I taking on this year and what am I not taking on this year? So,
by the way, I think that's a great point. I just want to emphasize the gracious no, because sometimes even in sales, you got to say no.
You got to say no.
This is not the deal for me. And
yeah.
Say no up front. Saves a lot of time and effort.
Well, I was talking to one of my technology clients. Technology is a great place to learn this, because if you say yes to everything, you know, then you'll never have a product that'll get to market. So it's that gracious no, but that persistent that we got to have a strategic focus to add value.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk about the process of when somebody hires you? What's the pain they're typically having where they call you, and what does the beginning of that engagement look like? What are your first conversations with this person look like, so you can kind of get a game plan so you can help them?
Gosh, you know, I coach across the spectrum, so the issues could range from, you know, I'm not being a great leader, or I feel like I want to change my game, to I've been given a promotion.
Or so like a promotion might be a trigger,
right? Yeah, promotion
right?
might be a trigger, for example. A lot of companies bring in coaches to help a leader onboard, because the first 90 days are very, very critical for success. How you manage your team, how you're setting your strategy, all of those
things.
So
you can help them with all that?
Absolutely. Help them understand. And I really focus on a three-part strategy. It's you with your team, you with your organization. And we have to figure out where the greatest challenge is. Mm-hmm. A lot of times there's you were talking about executives in denial. It really is about awareness. I mean, if you knew you were being a big jerk, would you actually continue to be a big jerk? There's a percentage of people.
Some people would say yes.
Some people would say yes.
Look, this is what you're
you know, I give people the benefit of the doubt. The majority of people want to be high value producing individuals, and they just don't have that awareness. So one of the things that we do through assessment, and I do a lot of work in emotional intelligence, is understand who they are and how they're relating. And then the second piece is, you know, if so you need to feel confident and powerful as an individual. A happy leader is a better leader. The second piece is just you and your team. How are you in managing and building those leaders and building your team, or how you position in the organization? You know, you may have a big initiative and need to kind of move it through the morass of bureaucracy and you know, roadblocks that are in your way. And so really we have to determine where you need assistance. And do a game plan, because, you know, you can't, you know, much like you can't be all things to all people, a coach can't jump in and fix everything and work with you to kind of develop everything. We really have to figure out what our focus is. And a lot of times we evolve. Once we begin to evolve and get them confident and powerful in one area, then that opens up next level areas. And I may work with a client over two or three iterations, or they may get promoted two or three times, because if I'm doing my job, that's what's going to happen.
Right.
And so we have a lot of really next level. Excellent things to work on. So as they achieve excellence, there's more excellence to achieve.
So now, what's the outcome that they typically thank you for?
Oh, gosh. Thank you. I've heard people say, you know, it's been transformative to my life. I do a lot of work with emotional intelligence. And when they realize that relating with people in a powerful way.
So it might help their home life.
Absolutely. People say, I can take that back. Absolutely. It does. You don't just bring it to the office. You can certainly take it back. So when you become aware and become, I know for me, and I went through coaching 17 years ago. When I started in my own career, and it just made me a better human being, I realized that some of the things that I was doing as an individual was impacting my success as a leader. And once I got that awareness, it changed the relationships with my husband, my family, my community. Mm-hmm. So it can be life-altering. I also get thanks for, hey, this is a big promotion and, you know, my 40% increase in compensation. So there are lots of different other benefits, but I think the ones that are most rewarding are the ones where people feel more powerful, they feel more confident, they feel more in control of their destiny.
So the marketing, the positioning for you, kind of like Victor's world, it has to be pretty elegant, right? So thought leadership mm-hmm. and distributing content and being available for that. How does the sales and marketing thing work?
For me, you know, I have to say I've been doing it for 10 years. It's a lot of word of mouth. It's kind of like picking a doctor or a physician. You can certainly go out.
Like somebody had a good experience and they got promoted.
There's a coach on every corner
these
days, you know. And so it's really, we get a lot of referrals through just doing great work. And, mm-hmm. and also it spirals out. You know, you can have one person in an organization when you do a great job and people begin to see it. There's such tangible results that they're like, everybody's saying, I want some of that. I want to be a role model leader too. Wow, he got promoted. She got promoted. How'd that happen? And people are often happy to say, gosh, I had a great coach that helped me recognize some of the regimen I needed to put in place to be better and be more effective. So,
but they don't keep you a secret? Like they're not like, you know, on the down low? Yeah. I'm just really good.
No. It's funny. I was just talking with our marketing person, and that is absolutely there are some CEOs. It's like when I was in the public relations industry, we would work on crises. The best crises I ever worked on, I can't talk to you about because you know we solved them before they became public relations issues. So I have a lot of clients and a lot of CEOs that
like best kept secret
absolutely
kind of thing, right?
So I get to be their secret weapon kind of behind
and you're
the
like
scenes.
Hey, make some referrals here.
Well, I just say, you know, for those types of relationships, you get referrals. They're just different kinds of referrals. I think, you know, I'm a recovering introvert and the anti-motivational speaker. I was listening to Victor talk about his motivational excellence, but I think coaching is a very personal relationship, mm-hmm. I think confidentiality mm-hmm. with you and your coachee is really imperative. So,
sure. You
know, even with LinkedIn, I don't proactively reach out. You know, people reach out to me because I think it's just, and I think it may be because I did a, you know, after my career, I got my master's in counseling, and there's just people share such personal issues
sure.
with you. I think it's just really important that you hold that confidentiality.
Okay, so if they don't learn the secret handshake at the club or get a whisper there from one of their colleagues, how can our listeners reach out and learn more?
Well, they can certainly go to our website at Acceleration Partners, and that's Excel, E-X-C-E-L for excellence, acccelerationpartners.com. And we'd be happy to talk with them about leadership development, executive effectiveness, emotional intelligence, or anything that's going to help a leader, a team, or an organization be rocking powerful.
And you do have some thought leadership kinds of access to some good content just by
absolutely.
Website,
there's
right?
some information, or we're happy to share white papers and other things that we're doing with our clients, from women's leadership to emerging leaders to other types of results we're getting for clients.
Outstanding. Hey, hang out with us while we visit with our next
guest.
I will.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Next up on Midtown Business Radio, we have with us from Uncle Matty-O's, Matt Andrew. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you. So tell us a little bit about your approach to selling it.
First of all, will these two work for food, by the way?
But you don't need to ask about fee structure.
Lifetime of pizza, maybe salads, paninis.
I'm open to something like that
working, right?
There's a lot of IQ points in this room, isn't there?
That's right. I'm sitting here going, I'm in a real simple business. We're in the pizza-making business. These guys are in the intelligent businesses. But no, thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, this guy's being very modest. I mean, he's accomplished a thing or two in his time, hasn't he, Lee?
Absolutely. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Uncle Matty-O's was really born out of my experience being one of the co-founders of Moe's Southwest Grill, and had a great in-depth understanding, having to help grow that team from its inception all the way through to when we sold it back in 2007 to focus brands, Rourke Capital. At the time, Moe's, we had about 400 units open and another 500 units in development. And the takeaway that I was able to learn among lots of things was why those engine components worked. Moe's was a smashing success from a franchisee perspective, very proven, successful model. And so in thinking about my next steps after we sold Moe's, basically the underlying goal was to merge a 100-year-old industry, pizza, with this new proven service model made to order for you, that Moe's model, that Chipotle model. And essentially we combine those two things together, and it's a very powerful model that customers are taking note of, not only here with Uncle Matteo's brand, but you know, we're seeing this category emerging across the United States. So it's a real testament to what we invented about 5 years ago, that made-to-order, better-for-you pizza.
Now, when you walk in, do they say, welcome to Matteo's?
We actually say, ciao, Matteo's. So,
ciao, Matteo's.
Yeah, which means, of course, hello and goodbye in Italian. Right. But, you know, and that's part of it, too. We're in the entertainment business. We like to say...
it's experience, right? You're trying to create an experience.
We're in the eatertainery business, is a word that we like to coin. And, you know, essentially, at the end of the day, you know, we're not, you know, brain surgeons and things like that. People come to our restaurants. They want to enjoy a healthy menu item, whether it's a pizza, salad, or panini. They want to get together with a friend, whether it's a coworker or at night with their family, and they want to share good times. We just happen to be the vehicle that can provide that. We provide it in a cool, cutting-edge way, the sort of the next-generation pizza joint.
Now, when you were with Moe's, were you there at number one, Moe?
I joined at number two, Mo.
So, okay. So, it was from inception, were you looking to blow it out and have 100?
Yeah,
so
absolutely. It was always the goal to be the dominant burrito guy. And by the time we sold it, I think we were the second in the industry behind Chipotle. Chipotle had always been the industry leader, and there were a number of other competitors in the category, not unlike there are today in our pizza category, but today we enjoy the lead in the pizza category.
Right, because pizza, I mean, there's a lot of mom and pop, just some guy's pizza place, right?
Absolutely. The United States, in fact, the world, as we go around it, are, you know, we didn't invent pizza. We invented the next way to offer pizza.
Right.
And that's really, it's a service model niche, if you will, that we offer to our franchisees as a business in a box. This idea that, you know, the old days of going to a local mom-and-pop pizza place, while there's many of them and they're great competitors and friends, and it's so nice that they have available product. What's interesting is there's a transformation that's occurring in this category, and that is, and it has to do with the demographics and how it's maturing. You know, young kids today, they're not necessarily growing up on what we perhaps grew up on, that traditional QSR, going to McDonald's on a Friday night or Burger King and things like that, when it was like a big deal to do that.
Right.
Those are great brands. Don't get me wrong. But today, kids have choices. They have choices to go to better-for-you products, whether it's Panera Bread or Starbucks for coffee or Moe's or Chipotle for a burrito or Willie's here in town, and now Uncle Matteo's for pizza. So they enjoy that better-for-you idea that when they go into these brands, these establishments, they know a few things. They know that the food's going to be fresh, local. They know that it's going to be fast. And they know that they're going to be able to choose and get it made for them exactly the way they want. And that fits in today's demographics and psychodemographics, that people want control. And with these service models, which we didn't invent the service model, that model inherently gives you those control mechanisms as well as that speed and throughput at an affordable price. So you mix all that together, and it can be a very powerful business.
Now, in pizza, the crust is that's a key element there.
Crust is very important. The sauce is very important. So we've been very blessed to have acquired a very famous pizza dough recipe from up in New York, the Brooklyn area. And so we've got a very established 40, 50-year-old dough that's been just a smashing hit. Can't tell you where it's from. That's a secret.
Proprietary.
That's right. But
so now is
I'm
it,
getting hungry.
Is it New York style?
It's a New York style thin and crispy
it's
pizza.
It's not like those thick Chicago style.
Yeah, we don't think that that's on trend today. So, you know, people are looking for a little less carb, although they want the structure that a sort of a thin, slightly thicker than a thin pizza offers, which would be more closely related to what we'd call a New York style pizza. That's right.
Now, any gluten issues? Because, you know, gluten's in the news a lot.
You know, it's interesting. That's one of our fastest growing categories within Uncle Matteo's is the gluten-free pizza crust.
You can pull off a gluten-free crust?
We have basically three choices. We have the white traditional, we have a wheat crust, and then we introduced a gluten-free crust about 2 years ago, and it's just been a smashing success. It's amazing to me how many parents come up to me or kids and or just people in general who love pizza and say, I haven't been able to eat pizza in 10 years. Except for Uncle Matteo's introducing that gluten-free pizza. Thank you for introducing that. People today are aware of what they're putting in their bodies, not unlike they were maybe 10 years ago. So people are shying away from things that are filled with hormones. So we offer hormone-free meats. They're shying away from the pesticides. So we offer organic vegetables. They're shying away from gluten. So we offer a gluten-free crust. But, you know, hey, listen, we've also got lots of other choices. Some people want all those things.
I want extra gluten.
Exactly. let it stick to the sides. That's right.
All of our programming is dolphin safe and gluten free. We've mentioned that on the air before. But equally important ingredient here is this: the experience. I mean, so it really has a bearing on your recruiting and your selection and training. Speak to that a little bit, if you will, your recruiting and your training.
Sure. I think what people are looking for, franchisees, are looking for people that have a proven track record of being a successful franchisor, and that's what we're able to offer. And what they're essentially looking for is an organization not only that has the experience to guide them through the leadership process it's going to take to grow a brand from its incubation stage through its maturity stage and all those stages in between, because they're all different plateaus that you have to sort of bust through in order to get the company long-term where we want to be. But essentially, they're looking for a franchisor that offers what anybody would want in life to partner with a company with integrity, a company that treats them with honesty and fairness, a company that's transparent. Those are all the things we think that are essential to provide as the leadership organization for a fast casual franchisor like Uncle Matteo's. And so we combine those elements. We offer that as a platform. You combine that with a proven model, and it's a real great recipe for success.
So now, in this market, as a franchisee, is it hard to, like, how do they choose which franchise to buy? Are you looking for somebody that's going to buy a whole market, or are you looking for an individual guy that just wants a certain location? How does that work?
Our franchisees, as we look at the 40 or 50 groups that have purchased our 165 stores today, as I look at that demographic mix, the commonality that they have is that they've all been successful at something. We have absolutely, certainly a percentage of those groups who've been successful, whether it's in QSR, fine dining, fast casual, so what we would call experience operators.
Right, so they're just buying a different brand for them. Right, so they've already had success with maybe they own some Moe's, and then they also own some Uncle Matteo's.
We have a mixture of a lot of that. Whether they've had Moe's before, or most recently we signed up a partner who had 75 Burger Kings, and his whole 40-year career was developing Burger Kings. He exited out of that business a few years ago, and he wants to put his son in sort of what's the trend today. And so they interviewed all of our competitors. They had the time and resources to do that, flying all over the country to look at all the different brands. And essentially, when we asked them why they chose Uncle Matteo's, it was because what they felt was the strength of the brand, the strength of the management team, and where we were taking the company in the future. And so it's, you know, and again, that gets back to your earlier question. I think what people look for is proven success.
Absolutely. And then the people that you have to hire and train in the store, because they're creating that experience. Because as you're describing this, and I haven't been yet, but I'm going to go by the weekend. But like my mom and dad are coming to town
for
Christmas.
There's a free pizza
card for you. Oh, baby. Actually, I was going to go Saturday and Sunday. But no, my folks are coming to town for Christmas. And they blow in a couple of weeks ahead of time. And I want to take them for the experience. I'm trusting you that the pizza's good, but I'm also looking to show them this experience you described. So recruiting people to provide that experience, that's key, right?
Absolutely. We are as good as the people that are servicing our customers, right? So, in fact, we're analyzing several tools, one today with a group that's flying in to present to us, and that is there are some great tools today that can get to hiring crew members at restaurants. And it allows the crew members to go online, take a quick assessment test, you know, and understand their background, understand what motivates them and reasons why they either have been successful or not successful. So what it does for an owner or franchisees is it sort of weeds out those 80% that you perhaps wouldn't make a good fit for your company. And it's going to allow us to sharpen who exactly is the best fit for running our models, our brand.
So now, any tips for companies that are thinking about franchising, some do's or don'ts that, like how baked does your system have to be before you trust some stranger to open up a store in a different market?
Yeah, that's a great question. In my experience, when we started Uncle Matty's, we opened our corporate store, the first store, January 2nd of 2009. It was strategically, we wanted to have that open for 2 years. It's very important that the franchisor understands all the different intricacies that go into developing the successful
store. Right, because it sounds good, with a whiteboard,
right.
Drawing out pictures. And then when your first customer comes in, it might be a little different, right?
Well, incubating a brand that you know you want to grow into hundreds of units is no easy and small undertaking. So some people probably get lucky if they open up a store and everybody comes to them and says, you ought to franchise this. And they say, gee, that may be a great idea. And then they sort of stumble into it and go from there. I would venture to say that the stats aren't real kind to the long-term success of those brands. I think a strategic plan where you know you're going to have a platform that's a franchise platform where you support your franchisees, that's a materially different looking business.
Because you're building it for that purpose from go.
That's right.
You're not doing that after you've already got a system that wasn't built for that.
The blueprint of being a great franchisor is a blueprint not unlike having a house that you would design and you know exactly where the kitchen's going to go and the bathrooms and the basement and all that. It's a very strategic plan. And then from that, you build on top of that. To back into that would probably not be a wise move.
So now, in your personal background, you have come from when you were with Moe's, you knew that you were going to have multiple units. Like, that wasn't just a burrito place that, we should franchise. Like, it was built to franchise.
That's
now,
right.
Prior to that, was that your experience as well?
Prior to Moe's?
Yeah.
No, that was not my experience. My experience was in startup, high-growth companies, but essentially all with the same element of getting a proven model and scaling that model.
Okay, so that's always been your background.
That's right.
So you're always looking at expansion first, not just by accident.
You know, we live in a blessed country where if you get something right, we live in a homogenous country where it'll probably work in many other areas. And so I definitely have always been a firm believer in scalability and replicating a successful business model.
Is there any clues to tell what model can be replicated?
The bottom line on the P&L is a good one.
That's a good place to start. So do you have a favorite pizza?
It's usually the last one I just had.
Right?
Yeah, you know, and I get that question a lot. So, Uncle Matty's is all about choice, and I eat a lot of different types of pizzas. But I've never had a bad pizza, and it's usually the best one's the one I just get finished eating.
So the combinations are infinite, right? I mean,
infinite is a stretch, but we have
numerous.
We did have an Emory student who did the math, interesting enough.
Oh, wow.
Four crusts, six sauces, 27 vegetables.
So no one on your staff could have done this math?
Yeah. Remember what I said earlier at the beginning of the show, right?
He figured out the factorial, how many possibilities.
Yeah. But he did. In fact, he showed me his equation, and it was this page-long thing, and it literally was like 50 million combinations.
Wow.
And I'm like, we'll just go with that. I'm sure all that says that, but no, it's a lot.
Now, does a typical customer buy the same, every time they come, do they buy the same thing or do they try different things?
I think we're creatures of habit. I would venture to say that, 60% of the people probably get the same thing. Our job is to encourage, trial, and we do that through a lot of different marketing programs or LTOs that we bring out. But unfortunately, we can all get into the same habit of saying, I just want to get that one that I know I'm going to like.
Now, can you get it to go or it has to be eaten there?
No, absolutely. We do deliveries, not to homes, but to offices and caterings and things like that. People can call ahead and order. But most people, I would say 80% of the product's probably eaten in our establishment.
But you can do pickup and you can do delivery?
Yes, that's right.
All right, so I want to know where we can go to have a pizza, and then also want to leave our listeners with coordinates who may be potential franchisees, coordinates for them to reach out and talk to somebody.
Well, actually, it would be the same place. The simplest place to go to is just www.unclematteos.com, and you can find all that information there.
So you reel them in with a taste of the pizza, then you talk to them about the franchise opportunity.
And soon on the website, you're going to be able to scratch and sniff your favorite pizza.
This on your
Somebody
phone,
start working
right?
On,
on
that.
Your phone.
Yeah, on your phone.
So this is solid sales methodology, isn't it, Victor?
He's on it. He's on it.
Hey, hang in there with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
Thanks.
All right. Next up and last up on Midtown Business Radio this morning, we have with us the urbane environmentalist. I'm going to venture a guess that he did not drive here, does not have to pay parking after the show. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jim Hackler. How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm good. I actually rode my bike here. I almost got blown away, but, you know, it's, yeah, it's pretty windy out there. The good news is it's not raining. That's the one time I'm a little cautious in Atlanta is I'm not so hardcore that if it's pouring rain, I'm like, I use something like Zipcar or MARTA or WAP.
Right, so,
yeah.
Well, you've been very patient. I thought I saw you nodding when a lot of the comments were made. I don't know that I saw you taking any notes. Maybe you didn't want to waste the paper or anything like that. But you seem to be pretty engaged during the balance of the conversation. Yeah.
No, it's always interesting hearing the different strategies. I mean, I guess my primary work that I do is storytelling. And the story that I found, my training is as a broadcast journalist. And I've actually been, I worked at CNN. I worked in local TV for years.
You don't dress like the CNN guy.
No, it's kind of after owning probably 150 ties and maybe 80 sport coats and suits and everything, that the second you can get out of that, the environmental world is great. It's kind of like jeans and sandals and plaid.
So do you think that these kind of centers like Atlantic Station, where we're broadcasting today, where it's at live, work, play, it has, you don't really have to leave here.
Yeah. And that concept is called new urbanism, where you get into the mixed use, mixed income, walkability, where instead of having to get in your car, and there's been, I don't know the exact numbers, but they've been doing some research on Atlantic Station, and the people here are in their cars a fraction compared to people who are in the suburbs or even in other parts of Atlanta. That we go to these great places, like we go to Charleston, we go to Paris, we go to these places because we can walk around. We don't have to be in our car. And the thing is, well, rather than this just being a vacation area, people can live here.
Right.
And see, now I haven't owned a car for 9 years. And it's probably, speak at a lot of my world is green building and the work that I do. I used to be the director of Earthcraft House, and then I also work for the USGBC and headed up Lead for Homes. And I get an opportunity to speak at a lot of conferences, and it cracks me up. The one thing that I get the biggest reaction is when I tell people I live in Atlanta and I don't own a car. But the reality is there more and more people doing it, not only in Atlanta and Houston and Dallas and all these places that we don't think you can ride a bike or have access to public transportation. And we're starting to see just a huge mindset. To me, one of the more startling statistics out there is if you look at millennials, that 26% of them, and this is people from about 14 to around 30, don't even have a driver's license. That's gone up 5% from 10 years ago. And there's this they want to live in urban areas. They want the walkability. They're moving to these places. And then the other side of that, we're starting to see bicycle tourism. We're starting to see things like the Silver Comet. There's a movement to connect all these paths together where we have they've done it in Europe. We're talking about doing it here, where it's almost like a bicycling superhighway, where you'll be able to get on a path and go from major cities from place to place. And one of the things that I really try to encourage, and I think Atlantic Station could do a better job with it, is just there's this huge market out there to tap into that bicyclists are hyper-local. They will spend money. And just by putting a bike rack out front, that business is saying, we welcome bicyclists.
Right.
When I rode here, I had to go all the way to the back of the building, and I finally found a bike rack out there. You know, Atlantic Station should have three times as many bike racks.
Sure.
And there's a new place, Emery Point, which is this very, very environmental community. And I went out there for this event, And in the whole central sector, where they probably have a dozen businesses, there were two bike racks, and they were a single pole, right. So only two bikes. And I'm like, come on, guys. It's like...
Seems like an easy thing to...
It is. They cost next to nothing. They say like a typical... there's been some estimates on how much we pay for a parking space. It's about $16,000 for a parking mm-hmm. space. And that's one car. You could park anywhere from 12 to 16 bikes in that single space.
Right.
They're starting to do that in Portland, where businesses in the front, they have these kind of portable bike racks, and they're just kind of testing to see, well, are a lot of people going to use this here rather than putting something in permanent? And the businesses are clamoring for it because they find that if you can get a dozen bicyclists in front of your business, that's going to be a lot more of a chance of them coming in and buying something from you than one motorist who's in a car.
Right. And you're telling other bicyclists, hey, this is probably a good place to go because look at how many bikes are in there. Now, what do you think of these city bike programs like in New York where they have the sponsored by Citibank, where they have a bunch of bicycles that you can kind of jump on, jump off?
And we're going to be getting a bike share program in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I've used it in Europe. In Vienna, the way and they're all like slightly different. Like they have one down in Miami. DC has one that's real popular. They operate a little bit differently, but the one in Vienna that you pay €1 to sign up for it, and then you have a little kiosk that you go into, and then it just unlocks the bike, and then you can bike it around. And if you use it less than an hour, you don't pay for it.
Oh wow!
So I was there for a week and bicycling everywhere. And Vienna's not that big, so it's pretty easy to get from one bike rack to the other.
And then
I think
every time you stop,
Euros.
Then you're back to zero again.
Yeah, the second that you lock it back up, and there are different ones. There's a startup out of ViaCycle that guys started from Georgia Tech.
Right.
That I voted for at the startup. Right. I told you. No, I did. That was my
pick
of the
litter. It was Zipcar for bikes, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a little different where the electronics in most bike share programs are in the bike rack.
Mm-hmm. And theirs was on the bike.
And there they actually put it on the bike. So it kind of, they get some cities like Paris, they have a real problem where everybody's taking all the bikes from one side of the city and going to the other. And then they run out of racks.
Right.
And you're like, you're coming up to the rack and it's like, oh, this rack is full. And then you have to go to the next one and all that. And then other racks are empty. So the nice thing about ViaCycle is it's built into the bike.
Right.
So is it getting safer here in the U.S., or was safety not really that big a problem to begin with?
Or the helmets getting better?
Well, one of the things, I always have to crack up a little bit when people say it's a two-way street. And I'm like, you are surrounded by 2 tons of metal and shatterproof glass, and I have a styrofoam bowl on my head. So, you know, it's one of those where, yes, I know some bicyclists are irritating. I tell people it's like you're like the big beefy guy, and a lot of bicyclists are like a bratty little girl that you want to go up there and hit them, but that's not acceptable in society. And that bicyclist, when people honk and things like that, it's when someone honks at me, it's like they're screaming in my face.
Yeah.
And it's startling. Now, if they're honking at me because they didn't see me and they're trying to inform me or something like that, I get that. But if it's just honking for the sake of it, I will have to say that motorists in Atlanta are getting much better. Bicycling here for the last 20 years, and I tell people a decade ago, the muscles in my body that got the biggest workout were in my middle finger.
So now, who drives this kind of, I don't know what you call it, this kind of walkability? Is it the government or is it businesses?
I think it's a mix of everything. There's an organization called the Congress for New Urbanism, and they work with city planners, architects, developers. One of the first kind of test communities out there that they just kind of tried this concept, and it was very experimental. And is Seaside, if you've ever been down there, and it was kind of creating this idyllic little community that was very friendly and you could walk to things and all that. You just park your car and you never used it the whole time. And now it's really exploded where there are a lot of new developments that are doing that. One thing a lot of people don't realize is Metro Atlanta, we have the most diverse mix of new urban communities in the world.
Really?
We have everything from Serenby, that is a kind of rural example of like little villages.
Sure.
And it's very walkable, and the restaurants and everything. And the homes are close to each other. Like, most people think, oh, you're out in the country, you want to have a big 10-acre lot.
Right.
But then the problem with that is that you have to drive.
Drive everywhere. Just to check your mail.
Right, right. So it's Atlantic Station is another example where we've got high density here and the walkability. And it's changing around. There are obviously some suggestions I have for them where
you can drop it off at the front.
Okay. but I think what was compared here before, I think it's a huge success.
Right.
And it's just a great space.
But now, because this is a driving city, the places are kind of far. Our best hope is that each of the individual locales create their own walkable area.
Well, and that's already happening. The Atlanta Regional Commission has been working with some of the communities, and you're starting to see this with Roswell and mm-hmm. Smyrna and some places that don't really have town centers. Brookhaven
right.
is really starting to do some really interesting stuff with that.
And then is that driven by the government again, or is it driven by local businesses?
Probably the biggest thing that governments can do is, and this is changing rapidly as well, is it used to be when we had these codes that it was illegal to have a live space above a workspace. The whole idea of live work
was code.
That was a code?
That was against code.
Oh, so that...
That was illegal. That was illegal. And a lot of these...
I did not know that.
Yeah.
What was the rationale for that?
Well, we went from... We were going from like industrial where industry used to be very polluting.
On top of like an industry,
like a steel
mill, smokestack.
yeah, that old model of kind
of. But Uncle Matty's, I think I'd like to be on top of.
But you've got places like Emery Point where people are right above all the restaurants, and that used to be not that long ago. That was against code that you couldn't build something like that. So then they got variances, and I think finally a lot of the places are catching up to say like, yeah, this can be a good thing, and we're starting to see the reverse where you've got a battle right now that's going on with the big box store that's on the Beltline, and people are saying, no, we want this walkability. We don't want
a big
parking
box,
lot.
Right.
And with the big building, that we want this to be integrated into that.
Right.
And that's the thing, I think, that the success of the Beltline just shows that Atlanta can be walkable and that people are really hungry for that experience. You talk about experience with the restaurants and all that. It's like people just to be able to walk out and I think that sense of community where I'll go on the Beltline and I'll run into people I know and I'll stop in at Parrish and there'll be some people there.
Right.
And it rather than when you're in a area that you have to drive everywhere, it's like play dates and you have to set aside like an hour or 2 hours to do anything.
Right.
And when you're in a walkable area, you can just run into people
there's
and
a
have
sense
a quick
of discovery
little conversation.
It happens just organically from going through the process. And you feel better after eating at Uncle Matty's and walking home. You feel better.
That's right.
But it's also, I think, too, with they're getting some really interesting stuff from the business standpoint. Mm-hmm. When you have areas like you see in San Francisco and places like that, where you can have these like little business interactions where it doesn't have to be, oh, let's get together for coffee and spend an hour, because it may only take you 5 minutes to really have that conversation. And that face-to-face that they're showing more work is getting done in these walkable communities.
It's more productive. And the serendipity that occurs because you're running into each other a lot probably happens more often as well.
You get front of mind.
Right.
And you go to social events and do that. Well, here you're walking around, you go in the coffee shop. It's like, oh, that reminds me, I need to talk to you. Or, oh, we had those interactions that can happen when you are in a place that's very walkable.
I talked about Wilmington at the top of the show, and that's what I loved about it. It just felt so walkable.
And then you'd always see people waving to each other from across the street that you just don't see in Atlanta that often.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is one of the things they say with bicyclists is we wave at each other or you nod. There's always the nod that you're like, oh, another bicyclist out here. This is great. And the truth is we're starting to get we're getting millions of dollars that are going to be down in Midtown. You've probably seen some of the bike lanes that have started to be put into Ponce and on 10th. A friend of mine complains about he never sees anybody in the bike lane on 10th. So anytime around that part of town, they have a little meter thing there that's registered, and I just kind of ride back and forth.
They're counting.
So you got on our radar because we met you at TEDx Peachtree, I think, when we were doing a remote broadcast there. Before we wrap, just tell us a little bit about the experience of being a speaker at a TEDx event. What was that like?
It's surreal. There's like this huge amount of pressure. They're like, this is the talk of your life. And you're like, oh, great.
That's all.
And it was
get out there.
Yeah. And part of what they wanted me to do, and I do some stand-up comedy, and it's really I think it's a great teaching tool where you can use humor when you're talking about the environmentalists. And there are people who make fun of us who are outside our group that it's a little mean-spirited, it stereotypes, it's boring. Well, within it, there's, oh my God, environmentalists are some of the most hilarious people that are out there, and they have no idea they are. So one of the women that I met there, who's one of the co-chairs of it, was intrigued when I showed her always the urbane environmentalists. And I said, taking the mean out of green. And she goes, what is that? And I go, well, with a lot of my writing, I love to use humor and play and be very visual and storytelling, because the environment is science. And science writing can be very heavy with stats and kind of ominous and scary to people. And so I always try to come at it from, hey, let's look at some fun things we can do and let's have a sense of humor about it. And I find that people are more receptive to that. So she says, oh, you ought to submit for TED Talk. And I submitted this whole idea of mixing humor with my environmental work. But my proposal wasn't about living in Atlanta without a car. And she said, well, what do you feel passionate about? What do you feel really resonates? What do you feel is unique that you can bring to that? And I said, well, the one thing that I get the biggest reaction is living in Atlanta without a car. So I really dug around into a lot of the research. There's a thing called the Worldometer that kind of tracks different trends all over the world. And they say so far this year, 105 million bikes have been produced. That's twice the number of cars. And almost as many TEDx talks.
Wow.
So now, what's your day job? Like, what's your mission? What are you trying to do?
Yeah, where's the money in this?
Well, you don't care, right? You're just, it's art, yeah, art for art's sake.
I don't have the expense of a car. We spend over $8,000 or $9,000 a year on a car, and I get to pocket
right,
all
so
that.
You're so just, you have a bike and a lot of insurance, right?
Actually, I don't have – well, when I use Zipcar, the insurance is included with it. Oh, you mean health insurance.
Right.
Yeah. Although the truth is bicycle – we get so banged up that half the time we're like, oh, it's not broken. I don't need to go to an emergency room. So, yeah, we're kind of bad about stuff like that. A lot of my work is messaging and helping people tell their green story. Mm-hmm. I hate jargon. To me, the word sustainability is a big clunky word that's kind of thrown out there, and really just trying to figure out, well, what's your environmental story? And here's the bottom line about environmental stories that I work with. It's about people. It really is. The passion is there. The humor is there. Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of builder profiles for a number of publications. I've done blogging where it's just kind of, they just let me run loose and kind of find new and unique and different information.
But your impact you're trying to make is to have businesses like have more bike racks. You're trying to help people think about walking and riding their bike more and getting out of cars and things like
that. Yeah, I guess that's more my passion, but a lot of my work is riding it's funny, I've gone from broadcast news where producing is what, if you're the producer, executive producer, whatever the show, that you're kind of the grand poobah of everything and making sure things time and all that, radio kind of the same way. I've done magazines where I was the editor-in-chief. Now online, I tell everybody I'm a content manager. So I'll work with clients and just part of it is let's figure out what your stories are and then structure the website around that. And most people just have like a template for it and they just fill it in. And I'm like, well, what are your, and even the words you use, the headlines and things like that. I had one client I was working with and they do energy lighting retrofits, and they're able to have a financing thing where the business doesn't have to pay anything, and they figure out the energy savings and then kind of do this 0% financing is what it is. They don't have to pay any upfront costs. And they had financing as their category. And I'm like, well, financing is kind of dull. I go, let's put zero cost. Because if you're on that website, wouldn't you click on zero cost if you're looking at the light in there as opposed to financing? Because financing is where, oh, I've made that ultimate decision, but zero cost, what do you mean?
What is that?
And it was still talking about financing, but it was a very creative way to do it. So that's part of, I love to play with words. There was a project I had with Duke Energy, and there were these discussions, and they had some money for a museum. And they kept telling everybody, but we don't want it to be locked into the typical role of a museum and all these. And everybody dove into the details. And then when we were presenting, I said, well, if you really don't want it to be a museum, then just don't call it a museum. And they were like,
what?
And it was, it created a totally different conversation. And they went in a completely different direction. And it's kind of like, we get so stuck in these little details. And again, I love language. I've been a journalism teacher and love the play with words. I think that's what I love about comedy, is that you're playing with visuals and the experiences and kind of poking fun at it. So that's kind of
If somebody wanted to learn more, your website?
Yeah, it's the Urbane Environmentalist. You got to put an E on it. I wanted to be the Urban Environmentalist because I live downtown, but somebody already had the Urban.
Sorry about that.
So I got the Urbane.
And then Urbane Enviro for Twitter?
Yes.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Oh, sure. Sure. It was fun.
All right. And thanks to all of our guests. And this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Midtown Business Radio.